Welcome to a special Bengals Beat Podcast four-part series presented by Cincinnati.com and Inquirer Sports. The Bengals don't currently have a Ring of Honor or a Hall of Fame, but that's not stopping us, the Inquirer, from discussing who would constitute an inaugural four-member class should the organization ever decide to start one. So over the next 4 weeks, one at a time, we'll pick the members of our class and sit down for a podcast conversation with them, rehashing memories, discussing the state of football, and, of course, the current Bengals. Enjoy the series. To a special edition of the BBP, the second in our four-part podcast series where we pick who would be our four members of a mythical Bengals Ring of Honor should the team start one. And first of all, I want to say thanks to everybody that listened and responded to the first podcast with Anthony Munoz. If you haven't listened to it, I suggest you go back. Great stuff from Anthony on a number of topics. Really enjoyed talking with him. If you haven't yet, make sure you go and vote. Pick who your four would be if you were picking the first class of the Bengals Ring of Honor. It's on Cincinnati.com. Or you have the Bengals app, I would hope. You can go on there. You can vote in our poll there. And check out how the votes are falling. A little surprised by who some of you people are voting for. I'm not going to lie. I'm surprised at some of the people that seem to be very popular and surprised by a few that aren't getting as much respect as I think they deserve. It looks like maybe our choices might not end up on the side of what the popular vote would say, but too bad. But that's one of the most fun parts of all this. Thanks to all you guys that have been participating. We'll get to it here. The second of our four-member class. I think the first two are pretty much no-brainers in this class, with Anthony Munoz coming first. And the second, quarterback Ken Anderson. I mean, from 1971 to 86, he was with the Bengals, had 172 starts, you know, takes the team to the Super Bowl as a league MVP. He has longevity. He had the high points. He went to four Pro Bowls. Twice he led the league in adjusted net yards per attempt. Three times he was a completion percentage leader. Three times he had the lowest interception percentage. Went to the playoff four times. A great argument could be made for him being in the Professional Football Hall of Fame. I would probably be amongst those that say that he belongs. So pretty much no doubter, Ken Anderson. I was able to catch up with Ken, who lives down in Hilton Head, but comes up here very often working with his foundation, which does excellent work for helping adults with autism. Hope you guys check. He has a celebrity softball event at the home of Florence Freedom coming up. Hope you guys check that out. We went over to Dickman Sports Cafe, sat on the porch on a beautiful day, and just sort of let the conversation go where it went. We touched on all kinds of great stuff. Current Bengals, the parallels between him and Andy Dalton, certainly all the great work that he's been doing with his foundation and the evolution of offense. People forget that he went on and was a coach and a coordinator for a number of years, even won a ring with the Steelers. So, you know, just incredible football perspective. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Without further ado, here's my podcast conversation with Kenny Anderson. All right, welcome to the latest edition of our Cincinnati Inquirer Mythical Bengals Ring of Honor. We go through and start inducting our inaugural class, how we would see it, our first four, and talk to Anthony Munoz last week, who was the, I believe, on everyone's unanimous ballot as a Ring of Honor member and Professional Football Hall of Famer, where our number two was also unanimous for all those that were going through the voting period, which was Bengals quarterback Kenny Anderson is joining us. Kenny, thanks, man, for being
here. Well, thanks for having me, and I'll follow Anthony any day of the week.
Yeah, he you know he'll clear a path and keep you clean.
That's exactly right.
It's only fitting that you come right in behind him.
That's
exactly
right.
Well, it's interesting. We do these podcasts now, and often it'll skew towards a younger demographic, and some people aren't as familiar. So I want to run through. I did this with Anthony last week, and I'll run through some of your stats. I mean, it's pretty incredible. You talk about 32,000-plus yards, of course, AFC title, league MVP in 81, 1975, Walter Payton Man of the Year, four Pro Bowls, two times you led the league in adjusted net yards per attempt, three times you were the completion percentage leader, three times you had the lowest interception percentage, another two times you were second, made four playoff trips. It may seem like a long time ago, but does it still feel like man, that was you accomplished almost everything you would have wanted to for a career,
except for winning that last
that
game
one
in
yard,
the 81 season. Yeah, no, it was fun, and you know what was fun? I think you talked to a lot of guys from that era that you know we played in an era when the rules were different. We only played 14 games when I started off. I was talking with Mike Brown the other day. My first training camp started July 7th. We broke training camp September 15th in Wilmington, so we were up there 9 weeks. But in those days, you know, we didn't make a lot of money. There was no off-season program. Everybody got jobs in the off-season, and that's why training camp was so long, and we played six preseason games. So, you know, the off-season was training camp for us.
What was your off-season job?
Well, I had a bunch of different ones. The first off-season, I was at Fort Polk, Louisiana for 6 months for my active duty for the Army Reserve.
Yeah.
And then the next off-season, I went back to Augustana and got my degree because in those days, the draft was in January, and the rules were different. So the Bengals drafted me, and I moved right down to Cincinnati, which was the best thing I ever did. I only got a $7,500 signing bonus, and I went through that off-season living in Cincinnati, but I was with Bill Walsh 3 days a week. Yeah. Learning the system and it was the best off season, best money I ever spent.
Yeah.
Then I got a real estate license, did that for a while, and then I spent five off seasons going to law school.
Law school, real estate, and the NFL.
Just, right. and then started a couple beer distributorships. Yeah. And so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, times have definitely changed. Not a whole lot of guys in today's NFL are you know, working on three or four different jobs during the offseason. Man, what do you make? When you just talked about signing bonuses and doing other jobs, when you see the money that's thrown around, particularly at the quarterback position now, is it just astounding to you how much the game has changed and how different type of a person and a personal brand CEO you have to be to play in the league now?
Well, and it's all because of television.
Yeah.
You know, when I came into the league, I was a third-round draft choice, and what do those guys get? About $500,000 signing bonus now, and the league minimum's $480,000, something like that. You know, and I signed for $18,000, and my signing bonus was $7,500.
Yeah.
Now, which was a good deal because I had a teaching job lined up in Chicago, and that was only $5,000. So I was, you know, I thought I was ahead of the game for the deal, but you know, but now the players deserve the money. When you talk about the dollars that television and sponsors pay to the National Football League and what the owners have coming in, the players deserve half that money. They are the game.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's, you know, talking here with Ken Anderson, and it's we talk about how much the game has changed, and you mentioned Bill Walsh. It's amazing how much it hasn't changed in a certain way. The stuff that you and Bill Walsh sat down there during that offseason and taught and learned is still what's happening today in so many ways, if not more so, with all the quick passing game and the short intermediate throws. How much are you surprised at how that system and everything that Bill Walsh and you went through, Sam Weiss and you did, is still so prevalent and still at so much at the core of NFL offense?
Well, I think, you know, it's a couple things. Number one, it's the fundamentals of playing the quarterback position, and how he taught quarterbacks is still the standard today. In fact, I was reading an article, I think it was at USA Today the other day, that Jim Harbaugh was having this satellite camp up in Michigan, and they were working with the quarterbacks, and he said, well, you know, they were, you know, out shagging fly balls, hitting cutoff men. He said, well, Bill Walsh said that, you know, quarterbacks should be good at all these other sports, so they were working on other things as well. When you talk about terminology, a lot of the West Coast terminology is still involved. Yeah. I think his offense has expanded. You know, so much is three wide receiver stuff now and shotgun. And, you know, and Bill Walsh was, we were never in the shotgun with there. And, you know, we never went three wide receivers because when I played, there were only 40 men on the roster. You only had three wide receivers on the roster.
Right.
You couldn't go three. If one got hurt, you're done.
Yeah.
But I think that the principles of the offense, not only stretching the field vertically, but also horizontally, you know, high completion percentage, you know, using the running backs in the passing game as flare controls and not being afraid to throw it to those guys and make 4 or 5 yards on first downs. And, you know, it was successful when I ran it in 1971, and it still is today.
Yeah, it really is. What, you played so many years, and we're seeing quarterbacks now, because of the rule changes, are able to play up until, you know, Peyton Manning was 40, and Tom Brady, these guys, so many quarterbacks are playing in their mid to late 30s. And the way the game is set up makes it easier now, but when you were playing, I mean, what was the key to longevity, to having the longevity that you had, because you were taking a lot more hits back in those days. Well, luckily you had 78.
An offensive line was the key back in my day.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you could hit the quarterback in the head as long as it wasn't late.
Yeah.
You could hit him in the knees as long as it wasn't late.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the throw the ball away and it wasn't intentional grounding.
Yeah.
So it was harder for the receivers to get off the line until, you know, Paul Brown got that rule changed to the 5-yard chuck rule.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Mel Blunt would kind of bug Isaac Curtis. So we had to get that one changed.
Yeah.
But, you know, but you look back in those days and the numbers were down. If a quarterback threw for 2,400 yards, he probably led the league in passing.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, a good touchdown to interception ratio in those days was 1-1. If you threw 18 touchdown passes a season, you may lead the league. Because offensive linemen could not extend their hands. They had to be within the framework of their body. How are you supposed to pass protect? So you only threw the ball 16, 18 times a game.
Yeah.
If you're Bob Greasy down in Miami with Zonk and Kick, you know, you may throw it 12 times a game.
Yeah.
You know, unless you got behind. But it was a different game until, you know, the early 80s when they kind of loosened up some of those rules and then the passing game took over.
So the key was luck in a lot of ways, right? Because a lot of quarterbacks.
You know, I remember there was a great article a couple months ago on SportsIllustrated.com that they wrote about the 71 draft, which was my draft, which was the first year of the quarterback, that Jim Plunkett was number one, Archie Manning number two, Dan Pastorini number three, Lynn Dickey and I went in the third round, and then Joe Theismann won. So it was kind of a recounting of what the draft was like in those days. There was no combine. There was nobody went to New York. You heard it on the phone from somebody, you know, where you got drafted. But, you know, I think Plunkett made the comment, I was the lucky one that I went to Cincinnati with Bill Walsh and Paul Brown into a stable situation, and that offense suited me, that I had places to go with the football to get rid of it. So, you know, I generally had a higher completion percentage and a lower sack total than a lot of guys.
Going back to your MVP season in 81, when you guys go on to the Super Bowl that year, I don't know how many people know the story of the first game or remember that you ended up getting pulled out of that first game. Then you go on to an MVP season. What did you wonder if that was going to be it for you at that point? Or what was going through your head at the early part of that season when that happened? And then was that a stem directly to the great season that you guys ended up having, you think?
Well, you know, if you remember the year before, they drafted Jack Thompson, number one, as a quarterback, to throw in some most. He was my replacement.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of clamoring, you know. And when you look at the Bengals teams from, you know, 78, 79, we weren't real good. And, of course, Jack comes in then, and we had a new head coach in Forrest Gregg, and it was kind of, you know, let's move Kenny out a little bit. And, you know, and so we finished 6-10 Forrest's first year, but we felt we were getting better. You know, we had a great offensive coordinator, Lindy Infantine. Mm-hmm. Hank Bulla was running the defense. Dick LeBeau was on that staff. And so we were pretty excited going in, but, you know, it was that offseason. This was going to be Jack Thompson's time. And so there was a lot of pressure, mostly internal, on me. And I remember the last preseason game that year was in Cincinnati, and I forget who we were playing, but right before half, we're going into score, and I throw an interception that's returned 95 yards for a touchdown and got booed out of the stadium. And, of course, now we we open up against Seattle opening day, and I threw three interceptions in the first quarter. I know one was run back for a touchdown, the other one to the 1 yard line, and so we're down 21-0. Jack Thompson is hurt, so Turk Schoendar, our third quarter, comes in, and we win the game 27-21. You know, now the big thing, who's going to start the next week? And so we're going to New York to play the Jets, and their defensive line was the New York Sack Exchange. I think it was Gastineau, Klecko, Marty Lyons, and Abdul Salam. And I'm going, and that's we had a discussion with Forrest and Lindy. I mean, is it better if I come off the bench? Do I want to start? And so yeah, we met before that week started, and the end result was, Forrest, what do you want to do? I want to start.
Yeah.
And then I'm starting to think, why do I want to start? These guys are pretty good. And so we go to New York, and we're playing in the old Shea Stadium, and it's the same weekend as the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament, which was right next door to Shea Stadium. And the offensive line always took a cab or a van to the stadium early. Well, we get to the stadium on the team buses, and there's no offensive line. And we go out to warm up, there is no offensive line. And we've got the police out looking for them, and well, their van driver had taken them to Yankee Stadium rather than Shea Stadium, and now they can't get there because of traffic. And so warm-ups are about over when they finally walked out into the field. And so, you know, I think, you know, Lindy Infante is going to, you know, let me kind of get into the game, hand off a little bit. And, of course, the first play is a pass play, and the guys are ribbing me. And so I go into the huddle, and I said, all right, you're not going to believe this. The first play is a pass. I'm going to throw it to the right. Get your ass over and cover just in case something bad happens. And we went on and we won the game 31-30. And then,
yeah,
you know, I think my quarterback rating was 2.6 after the opening game. And then I ended up leading the league in passing that year.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you can't judge too early. You never know how a season is going to sort of unravel. And you end up, you know, in Michigan playing in the Super Bowl that year. And, you know, does it go away? I mean, you know, it was Super Bowl 16. We just had 50. You know, does it at any point during those 34 years does it fade, or does that 1 yard not burn you, or is it you kind of look back on it now and say, you know what, it's all good?
Well, you know, it wasn't just that 1 yard the goal line. I mean, it was, if I remember, you know, the team that scores first has a high percentage of winning the game, and they fumble the opening kickoff. We got good field position, and we make a couple of first downs, and I think it's third and goal on the 5 yard line, And I throw to Isaac Curtis, and it's intercepted by Dwight Hicks. And it haunted me for a long time until I met Dwight a couple years ago, and he said, you know, I got to tell you this, I busted the coverage. I shouldn't have been there.
Yeah. Well,
you know, we had, what, three fumbles in the game and another. We had five turnovers, and you don't win any game if you turn the ball over five times.
Mm-hmm. Is the Freezer Bowl still one of the most, the most memorable type of game, just because of the unique nature of it? I mean, do you get asked more about that or the Super Bowl?
Well, you know, I would think more about that because of the conditions.
Yeah.
And that's what led to the Super Bowl. And since we lost the Super Bowl, you know, the highlights got to be the AFC Championship game. And, you know, and remember Forrest Gregg in the locker room, his pregame talk was, well, man, it's a lot like going to the dentist. You know it's going to hurt, but you got to go anyway.
Yeah.
And I was just so proud of the way that our team executed. And, you know, everybody said, you know, it was unfair. San Diego, you know, won their playoff game in, what, 85-degree temperatures down in Miami the week before and have to come to Cincinnati, where it's 59 below with the wind chilling. And I tell people, I said, if you remember, earlier that year we played San Diego in San Diego and blew them out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, had they beaten us at their home park, we would have played the game in San Diego. So, you know, we earned the right to play it in Cincinnati.
Yeah. You after your career, you got into, had a lot of years coaching, and some years broadcast, but you know, you ended up as an OC. You did a lot of quarterbacks coach. Was it harder to coach quarterbacks or to play quarterback for you?
Well, it was more nerve wracking to coach quarterbacks than to play the position, because if I was playing, I felt that I could have an effect on the outcome of the game. And when you're coaching, when the game starts, you don't have a lot of effect. It's what you did during the week, and you can't control how the quarterback plays. But, you know, when you talk about one of the hardest positions in any sport to play, it's quarterback, that the decisions you have to make so quickly with so many things happening around you, it's a tough job.
What did you make of your experience in Pittsburgh that you had there? Because, I mean, you got to, you know, you guys won a Super Bowl. and all that. It was, people say, oh, Pittsburgh, the enemy. But, I mean, you know, did you really enjoy your time there? What was it like coaching with Tomlin and Arians? I mean, it was quite a crew.
Yeah, and the Rooney family.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing how similar the organizations were.
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while, the Bengals get accused of not spending much money.
Yeah.
But when we went to Pittsburgh, you know, even in Cincinnati, all our video was on a coach's desk, was on computers. You know, it's the same way when I went to Jacksonville. We go to Pittsburgh, the only computers that we had were the head coach and the two coordinators. And Mike Tomlin goes to Mr. Rooney and said, I want computer stations and all the assistants' desks. And his first reaction was, why? We've won 5 Super Bowls without it. I mean, he had a point there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the thing that you learn about coaching is you're a good coach if you've got good players.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is Marvin any different now than he was 7 years ago? And now they've had 5 straight years they've been to the playoffs. Well, you know, you look at the talent the Bengals have now.
Yeah.
They've got as much talent in their squad, really, as anybody in the National Football League, and as much depth. And you can't win without a quarterback. And certainly in Pittsburgh, you know, we had one of the best in Ben Roethlisberger. And I'm so pleased and impressed with Andy Dalton and what he's done the last 5 years. The Bengals have a quarterback, and you have a chance to win.
Well, it's funny. You know, it's kind of something you said, that maybe there's more similarities in the Steelers and the Bengals organization than people realize. And I think everyone assumes they're so different, and there's just this rivalry. But from your experience, do you find that really there's probably more of the same than either side maybe even would want to admit?
Well, you know, it starts, you look, Pittsburgh's on their third head coach since 1969.
Right.
How long has Marvin been here now?
Mm-hmm.
Most organizations, you know, Marvin he started off nice, and then they had a little dip. Most organizations, he's gone. Mike Brown is a patient person, believes in continuity, not only in the head coach but in the staff. And certainly when you have success, different members of your staff, you know, like a Zimmer and a Gruden, get head coaching jobs. But, you know, the system has stayed the same. They've stayed the course, and they're on a heck of a run right now. And that's always kind of been Pittsburgh's philosophy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Chuck Knoll wins a couple Super Bowls. They have a bad year. You're going to fire Chuck Knoll.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Tomlin wins a Super Bowl, doesn't go to the playoffs. The next year when we were there, you're going to fire him? Well, they understand the game of football. And, you know, I always say that the Rooney family and the Brown family, they're football people.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Andy Dalton, you know, a lot of people like to compare you to. Just for accuracy purposes and the handling of the offense and able to distribute. Do you see that? And did you see that in Andy even as he's matured? Or how do you see him being the same or even different than maybe some of your game was?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think what you really like about Andy is the progression that he's made every year. And I said going into last year that was kind of a make-or-break year for him. He was doing a nice job. He'd have some good games. And then, you know, when things aren't going good, you know, he couldn't make that play or get the momentum to turn things around.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, his fifth year was going to be a big year. And last year he was doing all those things. Mm-hmm. He could carry the offense. He could make the play when it needed to be made to turn things around. And I was so disappointed for him when he got hurt, because I think the Bengals, although A.J., you know, did a nice job coming in, I think the Bengals could have had a deep run last year if Andy had stayed healthy.
Yeah, I wonder if you see similarities in patience. The same way we were talking about patience with the organizations and coaches, you have to have that with quarterbacks anymore. Now you have to have your guy and go with it. And maybe a lot of teams would have gotten antsy with Andy Dalton in year 3. It's, oh, I don't know. But the Bengals have stayed the course. Is that continuity and allowing the quarterback to have confidence? I mean, obviously they had confidence in you for a long time. How key is that to franchise's stability as well, in that position as well as a coach position?
Well, you know, I always told a lot of people, I said, you know, after Andy's third or fourth year, I said, you know, if you knew, it said 4 years ago, you're going to draft this kid from TCU in the second round, he's going to take you to the playoffs the first 4 years, you just sign up right now, and now he hasn't won a game, so you're not happy. And I said, you know, geez, you know, I mean, maybe you'd want a quarterback that's a little bit better. I mean, there's Mannings out there in Brady. I said, where are you going to find him?
Yeah.
And I always kind of say, if every team in the league is brutally honest, at least half the teams want a better starting quarterback than they have.
Mm-hmm.
three quarters of the team want a better backup, and everybody wants a better third. Yeah. Where are those guys? And the Bengals are lucky to have Andy Dalton.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. It's interesting to see his development. And I think what we're seeing, and you saw this last year, even look at Cam Newton. Got two guys, same draft class, who both came under some scrutiny earlier in their careers, but teams willing to stick with them really were paid off by their development. And sort of what we talked about when we first started here, you have quarterbacks playing much longer into their careers. It's worth it to stick with them and give them the chance to hit their prime, because now you're not saying, oh, well, we're sticking with them so we get 3 to 4 years. You could get a decade of a guy even if you wait until they're 28 in that time, because of the way the league is and quarterbacks playing so much longer.
Well, yeah, but, you know, like I said, and where do you find these guys?
Yeah.
If you get one that can win games for you,
yeah,
you know, like I said before, you may want somebody that's better. But, you know, where are you going to find them? In the Bengals, I mean, we went through David Klingler as the high draft choice in the first round, Akili Smith, guys that didn't make it, you know, had mm-hmm. veterans come in, you know, a John Kitna and a Scott Mitchell, you know, a Gus Frerotte. You know, it's hard to find those guys. And,
yeah,
you know, and I think that what looks bright for the Bengals is they got a young guy in the wings now, you know, that may be a pretty good player down the road. At least he showed flashes last year.
Oh, yeah.
And they got him in a great situation. I think they got 2 years to go on his rookie contract. He's not eating up a lot of cap space. A chance to let him grow and then see where he's at, you know, 3 years from now. And, you know, if Andy's still playing well, you know, you've got somebody that's got a great trade value as you try to repeat the process. But, you know, I think we found out that you better have two.
No doubt. One thing I wanted to talk to you about is interesting. We had you 96 and 98. You were a Pro Football Hall of Fame finalist. Again, this, I mean, I go, when I go to the Super Bowl, when we're in these conversations, mm-hmm. we're constantly bringing your name up, and Anthony Munoz, and pretty much everybody you played with has stumped for you over and over again. Where are you at with that? At a certain point, do you just come to terms and say, listen, I know what I was, and I don't need that? Or is there still that piece where you said, man, I would love to get that opportunity?
Well, you know, I think the thing is, what does it take to get in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's different from a quarterback position than it is from any other position. When they're talking about a defensive lineman or an offensive lineman or a wide receiver, they talk about statistics. They never talk about how many Super Bowls did they win. You know, with a quarterback, that's the trump card. How many Super Bowls did you win? Although, you know, Marino never won one, you know, and he's in the Hall of Fame, and there are some guys that haven't. But I think that's what, you know, what everybody kind of looks for. I think had we won that game, you know, in Pontiac, I think I'd probably be in. But
yeah.
I don't spend a lot of time worrying about it.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is, I feel like there's a validation in the people that, for you maybe, that have been standing up, saying, hey, look over here, let's not forget that guy, because people get obsessed with numbers. Well, we were talking about this earlier. You can't judge numbers. You could look at the video game numbers that people, quarterbacks put up today. It's not fair to, because it was so impossible for you to put up the completion percentage numbers that you did in that era, when it was impossible to, you know, to have guys running free half the time. I think it says something too. I mean, it's one of those things where I guess you have to sort of say, well, just throw your hands up, and there's only so much you can do.
The only time it ever gets brought up is around the time when they're going to with the senior committee, who their nomination is, and somebody will call you and say, what do you think about it? But other than that,
Well, it was this past year, it was Ken Stabler. There seems to be a groundswell of, in the next few years, you should be the next one up on this list. So I'll be one of those people continuing to say that I hope that happens. It certainly needs to.
Well, if it happens, I hope it's in the next few years so I can still enjoy it. You know, when I'm young enough, I can still get around and go back to some of the functions.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, it should. There's certainly plenty of your former teammates speaking up on your behalf. I do want to bring up a lot of your charitable causes, because you've been doing incredible work, particularly with adult autism. here lately. It was January 2014 you officially started your foundation.
Yes.
Is that when it started?
Uh-huh.
I mean, just in that amount of time, we've seen all kinds of stuff. And you've got a couple of events coming up. I know first July 14th, you have the Celebrity Softball Classic, which is at the Florence Freedom Stadium in Florence. And so that's going to be, I imagine, a lot of fun. You've done that before.
Yeah, this will be the third year, and they do a great job with it. And our foundation is the beneficiary. You know, at least we were last year. This year, we've gotten a contract for another year, and it's kind of fun that you get a Bengals all-star team playing against another all-star team, other local celebrities. Yeah. And so I decided, you know, at my age, I'm a better third base coach than maybe I am a position player. So I tend to coach third base in that. But it's a great night, and it's a chance to go out and. And then everybody's come down after the game on the field, sign autographs. They've got a nice fireworks show. It's a fun day. And then September 25th, and all the details aren't finalized yet, but we're putting together a little semi-reunion dinner for the public with guys like Tommy Casanova, Bob Trumpy, Bruce Coslett, Sam Weich, Bob Johnson, Isaac Curtis, Anthony Munoz. So check out our website, which is kenandersonfoundation.org. There'll be more information on that. And then one thing I'm really excited about is about a year ago, I was with Dan Marino, who has an autistic son. He has an autism foundation down in Miami. And he said his biggest fundraiser was a stadium walk at Dolphin Stadium. So my beady little mind starts thinking, well, we have two stadiums three blocks apart. So October 16th, the Bengals are going to be out of town. They're playing New England at 1 o'clock. So we're going to start off and have a stadium walk at the Bengals stadium. We'll proceed to the Red Stadium, go around the warning track. Our post-game party will be closing off the streets at the banks and watching the Bengals game on that huge monitor that the Reds now have on their TV screen. So again, you know, keep checking out our website on that. You'll be able to register. And one of the nice things that if you're with the charitable foundation and you get a group of walkers and raise money for us, we're going to give you 25% back for your charity as well. So it'll be a great day.
Yeah, that is going to be an awesome event down there. I mean, the banks set up like they are perfect for events like that. And maybe it'll be the beginning of a whole lot of stuff like that happening down there.
Well, we hope so. And you know, and it's kind of fun putting the fundraisers together. We've had tremendous support, you know, from everybody in town. And my former teammates are very supportive and always show up to our things, and so we're very happy about that. But, you know, we started our foundation. My wife, Kristen, and I have a nephew that's severely autistic, and he turned 22, and so now he's in a group home, and so we kind of want to make living conditions a little better. And there's a whole wave of adults with developmental disabilities coming up, and what do we do? So, you know, we want to have this community aspect that we're putting together, and we've made a lot of strides, and we're getting closer every day.
And the biggest thing is giving them great places and great communities to live in, because right now it's just not up to par to where it needs to be, I guess.
Well, you know, it's how many families where, you know, in many instances the adult lives at home and the parents happen to be getting older. What's going to happen to my child who may be 40 years old when I'm gone? And then we're trying to kind of alleviate some of those things, that we have a place for them that they can live for the rest of their lives, and to become, you know, the best person that they can be, and get up to the highest capacity that they can as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's awesome work that you're doing, and you know, there's going to be plenty of time. Everybody, make sure you get out and check out that website, and hopefully you can participate in all those events. Well, before we let you get out of here, you know, we're doing our mythical Ring of Honor here, so we try to give everybody a chance to weigh in. Probably, I imagine, stump a little bit for those that you played with. So, of course, you and Anthony are the first two in, and we have a couple more that'll be coming up here in the next couple weeks, but who are some guys that stick out to you? Some names, obviously, out there. You know, a guy like Corey Dillon or Chad Johnson or Isaac Curtis, who we've talked quite a bit about. Chris Collinsworth, Max Montoya, Anthony brought up last week, saying he was probably one of those underrated players in Bengals history. Willie Anderson, who played an incredible right tackle. Who are some of the names that maybe stick out to you that you feel like deserve to be recognized?
Well, you know, the first one for me is Isaac Curtis. Yeah. You know, Isaac Curtis you know, had an unbelievable impact when he came into the league. And everybody talked about when Jerry Rice came in and, wow, what he did. When Isaac came in 1973, you know, in those days, if you caught 10 touchdown passes, that was a lot. And Isaac blew people away. They forget that he was a world-class sprinter as well. And I believe that they wanted him to try out for the Olympic relay teams. And so, but he was a football player that was a sprinter rather than being some of those guys that are sprinters that try to learn how to play football.
Yeah.
So Isaac is number one. And I think you got to throw Boomer Esiason in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, another league MVP, a guy that really, you talk about the no-huddle offenses, the way that they're going now. I mean, and Boomer was one of the first ones to master that with Sam Weich. And, you know, the command that he had, the tempo that he had, the things that he could do in the no-huddle for the Bengals was just amazing.
I wanted to ask you actually about Boomer, and because obviously you guys passed, you sort of, that was where your torch ended up being passed. And what was it like seeing a young Boomer Esiason come in? Obviously, he's very open about how in his early days he was brash and antsy to get in there.
Yeah. Well, we didn't get along all that great because he wanted my job and I wasn't really ready to give it up. But the thing is, as we both grew older, the more we appreciated each other and how I could help him out, what he did for the franchise, and we've become great friends.
Yeah.
And but it was not you know, all milk and honey though when it first started out.
No.
You know, he had the blonde hair. Yeah. He had a little bit of an ego involved with him, but turned out to be a great player. And like I say, it's been fun for us over the years to look back on that.
Yeah, absolutely. One other name that I wanted to mention to you that you saw play a whole lot and helped you out a lot would be Ken Riley, who, I mean, you talk about 65 career interceptions. You saw a whole lot of those. Well, you went up against him a lot in practices and all those games we talked about. What was the best part about what made Ken such a good
player? Well, his consistency. You know, and I think, you know, you talked about the number of interceptions. He played 15 years at cornerback, was a college quarterback at Florida A&M that was converted to a defensive back. And I think he doesn't get the recognition that he deserves because we had another quarterback on the other side, Lamar Parrish, who was the flamboyant guy.
Yeah.
You know, leaping Lamar, you know, and he was also a punt returner. And he tended to run his mouth a little bit, you know. But Kenny was such a consistently good player that you've got to throw his name in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the great thing about these types of things is there's so much debate because there have been so many great players that have passed through the walls of Riverfront Stadium and now on to PBS.
Well, what I like about it, though, is you look at the generation of players now or fans now, a lot of them think Chad Johnson is an old player.
Yeah,
you know, and that's only been about 5-6 years ago. So I mean, there are a lot of people that never saw me play or even Anthony play. A lot of those guys from the 70s and the early 80s.
Yeah.
And so I think what was fun about the discussion is when you go back and you start to find out that those players were pretty good. I mean, you go back and Google Anthony Munoz or YouTube him and some of the film on Anthony Munoz. I mean, that's why he's the best left tackle ever.
Yeah,
and I don't care who you want to put out there. You know, and so I like those discussions when you go back. And even the Chris Collinsworth, you know, who's now most noted as one of the great analysts for Sunday Night Football. Go back and watch him play, how good he was.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the 6'5", 6 kid, you know, 6 gangly guy that comes out of Florida, you know. But boy, could he run and run routes, and he had great hands and a great student of the game. And, you know, that there's a great history of the Cincinnati Bengals. I mean, you want to go back and talk about Greg Cook, you know, who was, unfortunately, you know, for his career, it was only 1 year because of injury. But had he stayed healthy, I'm never in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the players from that era.
Yeah.
You know, so I like that those guys get remembered. And like I say, we did have video in those days. It's hard to find. There is video.
Yeah, you can't just quite go YouTube. No. Well, you know, what's funny is, and then you start having the conversations about guys that are here playing right now, and you say, well, A.J. Green, one more year doing what he's currently doing, and you can argue that his career is up with all these people that we've been talking about, whether it be Chad or Isaac, because what he's done has been so phenomenal as a receiver. You start talking about Geno Atkins and a couple more years of him doing it, and you could argue him being one of the best players in franchise history as well. It's kind of neat to see how this group that's been compiled on this run of five straight playoff runs compares with some of the greatest of all time, because they're up there with all of these greats that the Bengals have seen in their history.
Well, you look at the career Andrew Whitworth's had. You know, yeah. You talk about tackles, and I think Tyler Eifert's going to be one of those guys when you talk about the Trumpies and the Danny Rosses and the ML Harris and the Rodney Holmans. I mean, I think he's going to be in that category as well. And I think that's, they've done a wonderful job of assembling talent. And the thing that really impresses me, and I'm not around the team a lot, but when I am, is for the most part, they're good guys.
Yeah.
And I think, the character has come back into play as far as the selection of players. And I think it showed off in the last 5 years with the consistency of winning.
You're 100% right on that. I think if you look back at one of the big changing points, it's when that locker room became one, I think, that really cared about each other and doing things the right way. And Duke Tobin talks about this a lot. He talks about how much he loves guys with charisma. And charisma and character sort of go together. And that you see it year after year. It's why they've been able to hit on such a high percentage of their draft picks, is you're drafting guys that it matters to them and that it cares, and they make good teammates.
Well, I go back to the years, and I was there when Chad Johnson, was a rookie. And then this guy, Chad was a good player and loved to practice, but, it's tough for him to kind of, keep his jaws shut every once in a while. And then you go and you bring in Terrell Owens, and now they're doing a TV show on Tuesday nights. Are they more concerned about getting ready for their TV show than getting ready for the next opponent? I mean, it's just there were too many moving parts going on. And now you see a group of guys with 53 players, and I go back to my era, we didn't all like each other.
Yeah.
We didn't all socialize with each other, but boy, we were close when we were in the locker room together. Mm-hmm. And that's what I see now. You're never going to get 53 guys, hey, let's go out and have dinner together. Too many moving parts. But you go in that locker room and you see where football's important and they're all pulling in the same direction. And these guys got it going on in the right direction.
Yeah, no doubt. I think you could get 53 guys to go to the same place if one of them just got a big contract, was willing to pick up a bill at the precinct. I think then you could maybe get all 53 to get into the building to go get their free meal. That might be the only time you could ever probably make it happen. I want to thank you a ton for joining us here. It's been a good time catching up with you and seeing how everything's going. And again, best of luck with all the stuff you've been doing with your charity. Make sure you check out that website. And these events are going to be awesome this year. I look forward to seeing all that happen. And again, appreciate you joining us. It's been a great time.
Well, I'll probably see you down at training camp on the sidelines for one of those practices.
Yeah,
and it'd be so nice, when you go there and I'm not in pads and it's hot outside and I can leave when I want
to. You get to leave when you want to. Yeah. I'm already sweating thinking about it.
I'm not here getting ready for training camp now. And I remember the days I said, my God, I'm 33 years old. I'm in my front yard doing up downs, getting ready for training camp with Forrest Gregg. And here I am with you sitting at Dickman Sports Cafe, and I'm going to have an adult beverage as soon as we're done. I'm not worried about getting in shape.
Yes, you've earned it, okay? And I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.